First, I'd just like to acknowledge my co-author, Gayla King. Couldn't be here today. No relationships disclosed. First, I wanted to give you my overview, background, methods, results, discussion, future work. Any comments or questions? Okay, background. So here's things you might have been hearing about heat waves. They're getting longer, more intense, more frequent, and occurring earlier in the season, which is not a good idea if you're thinking about public health, because we know that heat waves that occur earlier result in more mortality and morbidity because people are not acclimatized. So, you know, if we see an analysis of heat waves that are occurring early in the season, we always see greater effects. I keep having to revise this slide. You know, I said when I wrote this, I guess I said the first 5 months, hottest on record, and it was six for 6 months, and I know 2012 will probably be hottest on record in the United States. But in July, especially July of this year, there were over 40,000 local heat records broken in this country. And, you know, what we know about vulnerabilities, we know that elderly, children, athletes, outdoor workers, like agricultural workers, are very vulnerable. Other populations. And so what is like the main vehicle in this country to protect us against heat waves are these what are called heat products that are issued by the National Weather Service. And these are called heat watches, heat warnings, heat advisories, and they keep ramping these up as the severity of what they think the severity of the heat wave is going to be. When we start looking at this, though, there's these different Weather Service forecast offices. There might be multiple. I think there might be like 10 or 12 in California, for example, but there could be multiple forecast offices in each state. And when I started looking into this, it turns out they don't use consistent criteria to define these thresholds, like when are we going to issue a heat alert or warning. They vary by your forecast office, and they have the local autonomy to define. Like some of them will say, well, if it's over 133 degrees for 3 days, that's a heat wave, especially if it doesn't go below, you know, 80 degrees at night, that's our criteria. So they might use certain absolute temperatures as a cut point for when they're defining a heat wave, and this might vary in different parts of the state. There's also this algorithm that's developed by Kalkstein, which he's developed this algorithm that's calibrated to mortality, and a lot of Weather Service offices use that. However, fortunately, it's a black box method. We're not privy. It's a proprietary method, so we're not privy to all the algorithms and formulas for that. So the question that we had for this study is, well, are these heat products sufficient to fully protect public health? And to my knowledge, there's been no systematic evaluation conducted where these heat products are appropriately sensitive to heat-related mortality or morbidity, notwithstanding this Kalkstein calibration to mortality that I just mentioned previously. So we'll tell you what we did then here. Now you can't read the bottom part, but first thing we did is you can get a list of all the heat products from local forecast offices from the Weather Service. So this is just an example of what you get. You know, it will give you what it was. Was it a heat watch, warning, alert? The date and time it was issued. Which zone? Could be defined by counties or other characteristics, and then when they issued it and when they ended it. So that's the first information we obtained. So we evaluated eight heat events in 2008 and 2009 in the San Francisco Bay Area here, and one heat event in Los Angeles in 2010. And this last one was kind of on request by the Weather Service because they said, it kind of got hot then, and we never issued a heat product. I wonder if anything bad happened. So, yeah, I'll look at that. So we had the time period then for each. We went into into temperature records and said, oh, here's where the elevated temperatures were. So we had, you know, temperature records for these heat events. And then just to kind of see if we can see a signal, we went like 4 days before and after each heat event. And then we were fortunate to have daily heat-related emergency room visit data. And these data are, at least in California and I think in a lot of other states, they're reported by zip code. That's a zip code of the patient's residence. So we tabulated those by zip code for each heat event. And then the next thing is we needed to know where, you know, these forecast zones are. And so you can actually get what are called the shape files. Any of you that are into GIS, these are actually the boundaries, you know, the geographic boundaries of these forecast zones where these heat events are supposed to be applied to this zone. And those are available for free. You can just download them from that link that I have there. And so we just, you know, downloaded those forecast zone boundaries, and then we had zip code boundaries also, and then overlaid those together. And then, you know, it wasn't a perfect match. So sometimes a forecast zone boundary would cut through some of the zip codes. So we just, proportionately weighted the emergency room visits events by the proportion of the zip code that fell within the forecast zone. So here are the heat-related emergency room visits. These are the codes that we included. And these are things like heat stress, heat stroke, heat cramps. Those are those ICD-9 codes. And if it was a man-made source of heat, and those would be like, people getting overheated like in factory jobs or indoors, that we excluded those. And then I already told you that we weighted the total emergency department visits by the proportion of the zip code that fell within the forecast zone. So here are the results. So I'll just go through a couple of these. So this is an event that happened pretty early, April in 2009. And so what you're seeing on the left-hand side of the graph is the number of emergency room visits. And on the bottom is, I didn't have that labeled very well, but those are the dates. So that's April 16th through 26th that you're seeing there. And that was the other thing that was kind of interesting that we had to grapple with is like, what temperature do we use? Because there might be multiple weather stations within a forecast zone. So I had to go back and just kind of, ask the weather service, well, what do you do? And they go, well, we use like one that's either the most reliable or the most representative for that forecast zone. So apparently they know what that is. It's not very apparent. So I just put a couple of down there because this included both, the San Jose area, San Francisco area. So there's maximum temperatures, so you can kind of get an idea that starting up like at 81 degrees and then, seems to peak right there on the 20th. And so you can see right before the heat advisory issued, starting to ramp up with some ER visits for heat-related illness. The advisories issued, advisories in effect, and they kind of nailed that one pretty well. Here's another one. May 10th through 22nd, heat wave issued. This time they were a little bit more proactive, so before the emergency room started peaking, they already had put in a heat watch in effect and then ended it right about the right time. And again, at the bottom, you can see the temperatures. And this is kind of typical. If we can get this really sensitive, you'll see a little bit of a lag. And so that the absolute temperatures will peak, and then the ER visits will lag a little bit by a day. And we've seen that in other studies. Here's a June 1. Bay Area getting up to 103 is pretty hot around here. So you can see the peak there. Again, it looks like they put these advisories into effect. They had pretty good timing on this. This one, July 4th, right after July 4th, again, looks pretty good. You can see the temperatures there in the bottom. And this one, again, there looks like a little peak afterwards. I guess I should have had some more temperatures there, but the temperatures might have gone up again, but there were no heat products issued there. May 13th to 22nd, another good pattern seen there. This one, September 2nd to 27th, so they issued the heat product. There was already a hot day that it looks like they missed, and it almost looks like the emergency room visits are going down. And then they totally missed this other one here, 25th through 27th. So you can see the temperatures peaked again, and actually we had substantial morbidity with people going to the ER, and no heat products issued for that, no warnings. And here's one more for the Bay Area. Looks like they have a pretty good pattern on that one. Also here in September 17th to 2009. Now this heat wave they wanted me to look at in Los Angeles. So this was one there, LA baking at 113 degrees. And no heat products issued at all during this time period. So you can see the temperatures we pulled off there from downtown Los Angeles, maximum temperatures going up to 113. And we looked at several different forecast zones, the downtown Los Angeles area, San Fernando Valley, San Gabriel Valley, and all of those areas were seeing, substantial morbidity. No heat products issued. So a couple points on this. So, the majority of the cases, it looked like the ER visits peaked right after the heat products were issued, so that was reassuring. You have to think about how limited this analysis was. I just looked at, a dozen events, and, I only looked at, it wasn't representative of the state. We just did, one in LA, some in the Bay Area, but it'd be really interesting to do these other parts of the states. But we saw these two cases where heat products were not issued, notable morbidity occurred. Discussions with the Weather Service said, well, this, we were relying on this Kalkstein algorithm, and there's built into this algorithm is a time factor where they say, well, by the end of September, we're thinking people are acclimatized by then. And so this algorithm doesn't signal alerts that late. So this kind of proves that was, at least in those two cases, that didn't really... That assumption isn't really working. So we'd like to do some more future work on this. We had limited funding to do this, but as I said, more heat products in different geographic locations should be evaluated. Now that we're having availability to morbidity data, it's really interesting to use this. And of course, it's a lot more frequent than deaths. So it's it's like a triple magnitude of deaths. You can have a lot of events for emergency room visits, so it's a great data source to work with. And then the other part you could do with this that we didn't do is we could say, instead of looking at times where heat products were, I only looked at one time where they said, oh, it's hot, it was hot and no heat products were given. But you could go back and look at just the temperature record and say, I want to put a criteria on temperature. And say, because the other problem with this is there's no universal definition of an excessive heat event. There's different definitions. So one idea that's coming up now is using a relative temperature threshold. So you can go and get like 30 years of baseline data on maximum temperatures or heat index if you're interested in that, which incorporates humidity on the East Coast, for example. And then compare that date and say, hey, does this temperature, this maximum temperature, is this above the 95 percentile? And say, I'm defining that as an excessive heat event. And go back, the last couple years and see if any heat products were issued at all during those times. So kind of define your own excessive heat event. And recommendation that we need to be getting some criteria establishing for these heat products from the National Weather Service by pooling evidence from national multi-city analyses, and that could provide the basis for kind of more of an evidence-based standard, a public health standard that could, and if you, it could still vary by local climate and other factors, because if you're going to be defining relative thresholds, you can adjust that in different areas, but still have a consistent methodology. So that's all I wanted to talk about. Just acknowledge Dave Reynolds from the Weather Service, San Francisco Bay Area, helped me on this, and me and Gayla. And funding was provided by the CDC to do this analysis. And be glad to answer any questions. Thanks. Yes, Audrey. Adele, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's a good idea. So the question is, you're kind of asking, is there any protective effect of the heat alerts? So we're seeing people going to the ER, but did it help? You know, did this prevent any morbidity? So we didn't structure this analysis to look at that. So I guess you would have to get a number of events where you actually saw morbidity and somehow come up with an algorithm that said for each degree, and there's some work that's been done by OEHA here in California to look at this, for each degree we expect a certain percentage increase in mortality. And actually you could maybe use their algorithms. And you could say, I'm going to compare the total morbidity or mortality during a time when no heat products were issued compared to the time when they were issued. And is this relationship between each degree increase and morbidity and mortality, is that different during the times when heat products were issued? That's what you would have to do. That would be interesting. Yeah. Good idea. Yeah, in the back, sorry.
Great presentation.
Thanks. Okay, thanks. So your first question was, why did we look, especially in relation to outdoor workers, why did we look at the zip code of residence of the patients as opposed to where the zip code of occurrence where the actual heat wave happened, to look at maybe agricultural workers or construction workers? The data isn't available for that, unfortunately. So we get these data from an office that has all the hospital admission and discharge data. And so the data is reported by where the zip code of the patient's residence. There is occupational fatigue. You can get out heat fatalities by in an occupational database, and our occupational health branch has looked at those data. I'm not sure, and maybe somebody else knows from the occupational area, what type of locational data is available. But that would be interesting analysis if you could get some locational data from, I think they're from Doctor's First Reports. They have to go get it reported to the OSHA, Cal OSHA in this case, and then also to our occupational health branch. So they get some data. I don't know if it's just by occupation and what type of locational data, but if they have locational data that could be classified by zip code, then you could look at something like that. And maybe he has an answer to that. And then the No. And then the second part of your question, I'm not familiar with that. It was a healthcare information technology grant that you were referring to. So if I'd like to find out more about that, that would be great. Thank you.